This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
When the light rested upon me, I saw two personages whose brightness and glory defy all description standing above me in the air. And then right there at that point, there's a insertion, a little notation marked by Willard Richards, his secretary, for an insertion. And that was inserted and added. And this is what the insertion read.
That's next on the Joseph Smith Papers.
From the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Channel now presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
When Joseph Smith came out of the Grove in the spring of 1820, the vision he had experienced was his and his alone. But now, in hindsight, we see its primal significance to Mormonism as the Restoration unfolded. The first vision became the founding moment of Mormonism. In a previous episode, we talked about the first vision account written in 1832. Tonight, the scholars will talk about those other accounts of the first vision contemporary to Joseph Smith. We will see how on a limited basis Joseph Smith told of his experience to others until finally in 1842 he himself publishes it to the world. We begin in late 1835.
Dean C. Jesse.
Second account that we have a record of is dated in 1835. And it was on November the 9th, 1835, that this kind of a character, an eccentric type fellow, came to his door and wanted to see Joseph Smith, and he invited him in.
James B. Allen.
Joseph Smith was visited by a man whose name was Robert Matthias, but he called himself Joshua, the Jewish minister. They found out later that he was a fraud. He really wasn't a Jewish minister. But during the conversation, Joseph Smith told Joshua his early experiences, and a scribe began to write down what it was that Joseph Smith was saying. It's noteworthy because it clarifies some of the things that were left out of the 1832 account.
But the account, which was entered in Joseph Smith's journal, it's in the handwriting of Joseph Smith's clerk, Warren Parrish, and it was probably dictated right soon after, or maybe he took notes right at the time and then copied them in. But in this account, we pick up a few things that we don't get from some of the other accounts. And so it's important, I think, to focus upon those. For example, the struggle he had when he knelt in the grove, or when he went out to pray. He says that, I called upon the Lord for the first time, he says. Information was what I most desired at this time, and with a fixed determination to obtain it, I called on the Lord for the first time. I made a fruitless attempt to pray. My tongue seemed to be swollen in my mouth, so that I could not utter. I heard a noise behind me like someone walking toward me. I strove again to pray, but could not. The noise of walking seemed to draw nearer. I sprang upon my feet and looked around, but saw no person or thing that was calculated to produce the noise of walking. I kneeled again. My mouth was opened and my tongue loosed. I called on the Lord in mighty prayer. A pillar of fire appeared above my head, which presently rested down upon me and filled me with unspeakable joy. A personage appeared in the midst of this pillar of flame, which was spread all around and yet nothing consumed. Another personage soon appeared, like unto the first. He said unto me, thy sins are forgiven thee. He testified unto me that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. I saw many angels in this vision. And he says, I was 14 years old when I received this communication. He's reconstructing it nearly as follows. It's the way it's written here. So what's being given here is a reconstruction written after the event, evidently. So there is room for, you know, a little bit of difference, possibly. Basically, I think it's like he said, he saw many angels in this vision. And this is the only place that comes up. And so that's quite interesting, I think.
The November 1835 account of the first vision, as we've already explained, occurred during one of the best documented times of Joseph Smith's life, which explains why the account exists at all. Now, it was also in 1835, just a short time later, that Joseph Smith similarly took occasion to share his first vision with an inquiring visitor. His name, Erastus Holmes.
A few days later, on the 14th of November, 1835, a man by the name of Erastus Holmes comes to Joseph Smith's home, and he wants to learn about the church. And Joseph invites him in, and we have a little account talking to him in the same journal of Joseph Smith just a few days after the coming of this Matthias character. And he says, a gentleman called this afternoon by the name of Erastus Holmes. He called to make inquiry about the establishment of the church. He says, I commenced and gave him a brief relation of my experience while in my juvenile years, say from 6 years old up to the time I received the first visitation of angels, which was when I was about 14 years old, and also the visitations that I received afterward concerning the Book of Mormon. And that's all he says. So from that, we can assume, of course, the visitation of angels being when I was 14. That's obviously referring to the vision that we've just described here, although he doesn't give a description of it, or at least it wasn't recorded in his journal.
And that's what's important, is to realize that by this time, Joseph Smith was not adverse to telling people about the vision if they were to come and ask him about it. He wasn't publishing it yet, but he was at least telling people privately about it.
3 years later, 1838, the church's headquarters had moved from Kirtland to far west Missouri, and Joseph Smith recognized the vital importance of a history, a record in his mind that would disabuse the public's erroneous perceptions of Mormonism. So, accordingly, he began his history and the account of his life virtually with his telling of the first vision. This 1838-39 account is the official telling of the story, and his account of the first vision was canonized in the Pearl of Great Price.
When Joseph Smith arrived in Missouri, in far west Missouri, in March of 1838, the following month, toward the end of the month, he and Sidney Rigdon and his clerk, George W. Robinson, sat down, and Joseph Smith began dictating what we have as his history that we're familiar with, the documentary history of the church. Eventually, it would become a six-volume, 2,000-page history. It wasn't completed until after Joseph Smith was dead, but it was based on his journals and his records and so on, and it was completed according to the rules and the format that he had established at the beginning.
He had his scribes helping him prepare this account because he fully intended it to be published. It's a very polished account, written after he had taken time to consider the importance of the many things that may or may not have been said before and that probably should be said in this particular account.
This was well prepared. It was written and it was considered by early leaders as an inspired document, and later it was accepted as truth and revelation. And that is the standard. That is the one that we should judge all other accounts by, because that was written by a prophet.
The first part of that, containing the account of his vision, was written in 1838 there in Missouri. And the account that we have of it is essentially, it's basically the way it is in our present printed canonized version in the Pearl of Great Price. And of course the characteristics of it, it focuses upon things that are somewhat different than some of these other accounts.
He had to indicate at the beginning of it why he finally decided to publish it. And you know, he said, and it's right at the beginning of the account that's in the Pearl of Great Price, "Owing to the many reports which have been put in circulation by evil disposed and designing persons in relation to the rise and the progress of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, all of which have been designed by the authors thereof to militate against its character as a church and its progress in the world." And he was really caught well the spirit of what was happening, because there were so many people who were vilifying him. They were vilifying the Mormons. The Mormons had already been persecuted a lot. So he said that this is the reason that I'm now trying to put out the truth about what happened. So he said, "Because of this, I have been induced to write this history, to disabuse the public mind and to put all inquiries after truth in possession of the facts as they have transpired in relationship to both myself and the church, so far as I have such facts in my possession." Well, I think that was a powerful statement, but it really reflected all of the sorrow that Joseph felt for the lies and the unfortunate things that had been said about him and about the church up to this point.
He deals with his family background and so on, and tells of the family struggle, his father's family being proselyted by the Presbyterians and the Methodists and so on, and how he became partial to the Methodists and so forth. But he said he became somewhat partial to the Methodist sect, and I felt some desire to be united with them.
As you consider the four accounts, though, there's only one account where Joseph actually identified the father, and that was in the 38 account. And he said that he beheld a light, a brilliant light, and in that light he saw two glorious personages who exactly resembled in each other in likeness and features. And the one personage turned to the other and said, "This is my beloved son, hear him." That's the account where he identified the father and also the son. And therefore, Joseph was called by name, "Joseph, this is my beloved son."
But by this time, he was a more mature person. He had more maturely thought of the kinds of things that were important, perhaps even doctrinally important. And that's one reason we get a precise definition of the father and the son, who were two distinct persons. He makes that very clear in all of the accounts except one, because I think he realized more fully than he did early in his life how important that particular doctrinal emphasis was.
In the 38 account, Joseph Smith said, "And I learned many other things." And that's the most detailed account we have. Now, you learn some of these other things by turning to the 32 and the 35 and 42 accounts. But that doesn't mean that any of those accounts are complete. That doesn't mean that we know everything that he learned as a result of this first experience with the Lord.
1842. The prophet Joseph Smith and Willard Richards, the church historian, reviewed the 1838 account of the history in preparation for its publication in the Times and Seasons. As part of that process, Joseph instructed Willard to make the following interesting clarification in the text.
"When the light rested upon me, I saw two personages who whose brightness and glory defy all description, standing above me in the air. And he goes on and he says, and when I, after this, he says, when I came to myself again, I found myself lying on my back, looking up into heaven. And then right there, at that point, there's a insertion, a little notation marked by Willard Richards, his secretary, for an insertion. And that was inserted and added. And this is what the insertion read. And this was added in December of 1842, even though the rest of the history had been written in 1838 in Missouri. When the light had departed, I had no strength. But soon, recovering in some degree, I went home. And as I leaned up to the fireplace, mother inquired what the matter was. I replied, "Never mind, all is well. I am well enough off." I then told my mother, "I have learned for myself that Presbyterianism is not true. It seems as though the adversary was aware at a very early period of my life that I was destined to prove a disturbance and annoyer of his kingdom. Or else why should the powers of darkness combine against me? Why the oppression and persecution that arose against me almost in my infancy?"
Now, this insertion into Joseph Smith's history after his heavenly experience suggests that the only thing Joseph shared with his mother was his certainty about his well-being and his enlightened understanding of the Christian world at the time. No more.
Donald L. Enders.
Joseph was a person who kept sacred things close to his heart. He didn't speak a great deal about them. Even his mother alludes to that perspective in his life. Also, the first vision was a very personal experience to him. It was his own Christian experience. And he didn't speak much of it. Now, we have a perspective that Joseph went right home from the woodlands following the vision and told his mother. Let's look at the data and kind of think about that for a moment. He went home, and as is stated in the 1838-39 account, and his mother asked him if he was all right, sensing that that he was ill or something. And he said, "Mother, I'm well enough off. I've learned for myself that Presbyterianism is not true." When he said, "Never mind, Mother," that basically was saying, "Mother, I'm not going to tell you I feel like I do." In the 1832 account, his own personal handwritten account, where he's expressing his emotions, his feelings, his remembrance of this marvelous vision, that he says that there was none who believed the heavenly vision and that he was hurt deeply by that. Now, he didn't put a disclaimer on it and say, "Well, everyone except my family, but my family did believe." No, it wasn't the case. He said, "None believed the heavenly vision." It's insightful that had the family really known of the first vision, then why did Lucy, Hiram, Sophronia, and Samuel all join the Presbyterian Church in probably 1824, slightly after Alvin's passing? And why did they remain active in the Presbyterian Church clear up probably until September of 1828, a year after Joseph obtained the plates?
It would not be until the church's October 1880 General Conference that the 1838 account of the first vision would be canonized as Scripture as part of the Pearl of Great Price.
Joseph Smith's history that contains what I call the official account of the first vision, the one that you have in the Pearl of Great Price, was published first in 1842 in the church's newspaper, The Times and Seasons. And then later on, it was published in the newspaper in England called The Millennial Star. And then later on, it was published serially in the Deseret News. It was included in the Pearl of Great Price in 1851. That was the first edition of the Pearl of Great Price. And the Pearl of Great Price was accepted to Scripture in 1880. And so what we now call Joseph Smith's history is now scripture since 1880. Before that time, it was a good and inspirational story, but not necessarily expected or accepted as scripture.
Ronald O. Barney.
One might ask the question, with four different accounts created or at least sponsored by Joseph Smith himself during his lifetime, which described his first visionary experience, why did we settle on the 1838-1839 account? Especially when it is the case that one could argue that there are features of the 1835 account, there are details of it, for example, one heavenly being coming down first and a succeeding heavenly being coming down second. Why didn't we settle on that version of the first vision as our codified official version? It was captured in Joseph Smith's own journal, so its legitimacy is beyond dispute. Something happened in the early 1840s, it looks like, by the church historian Willard Richards, who of course was Joseph Smith's primary scribe for the last 3 years of his life, was an apostle in the church, and was the individual most responsible, one could argue, for the perpetuation and fulfillment of the serialization of Joseph Smith's history that began in the Times and Seasons and was completed in the Deseret News. For reasons that we do not know, Willard Richards deleted the publication of the 1835 account in this serialization of Joseph Smith's life, which he could have done, because he had access to the diary, because Joseph Smith, in an unmistakable way, identified this lengthier account of the first vision, the standard authorized account, as the one that he wished to be popularized. Willard Richards took that cue and diminished the publication and popularization of the earlier 1835 account. Now, I can't speak to why he didn't include the 1832 account or the 1842 Wentworth letter to try to expand the scope of Joseph Smith's telling, but clearly he recognized that Joseph's intent was to tell the story by way of this 1838-1839 version.
Now we come to an important account of the first vision that was neither written by Joseph Smith nor dictated by him, but it was the first one of all of them that was ever published. And in all places, it was in Scotland. Now that's not to say Joseph had no influence. It was obviously influenced by his telling of the experience.
But in 1840, Elder Orson Pratt, one of the members of the Quorum of the Twelve who were performing that tremendously important mission in England in 1840-41, wrote a pamphlet that was called An Interesting Account of Several Remarkable Visions. And it's the first time that the first vision in particular had been written down by somebody for the purpose of publication. Orson Pratt had a very dramatic way of telling the story, but he obviously got his information from Joseph Smith and Joseph Smith's permission to publish it. And so it becomes a very important early document historians are very happy to have because of some of the extra details that it gives.
He deals with something that we don't have in some of the other accounts. And I should point out that Orson Pratt was in a position to record this. You can tell from the account that Orson Pratt left that he had close contact with Joseph Smith. And he says himself later on that on many occasions he heard Joseph Smith tell this experience. And as you read the Pratt account, you can see that it was written by somebody who knew specifically and in great detail what took place. And I think it's very important for that reason.
And this pamphlet was sold in in Europe. It was sold in New York, and then finally it was being sold in Nauvoo, and Joseph had access to it. And Joseph really liked it because he took excerpts from that account, included in his Wentworth letter, which included the account of the early history of the church and the Articles of Faith. And so basically that document by Orson Pratt is very significant.
March 1842, Nauvoo, Illinois. The prophet Joseph Smith published in the church's newspaper, The Times and Seasons, the first published account of the first vision in America ever. It was part of a letter called the Wentworth Letter.
It was written by Joseph Smith at the request of a man named John Wentworth, who had a friend named George Barstow. Barstow wanted to put a history of the Mormon Church, as well as other churches, in his history of New Hampshire. And so John Wentworth asked Joseph Smith to prepare that history for him.
We don't have the original. He sent it, evidently, to John Wentworth, who was the newspaper man, who requested it. Wentworth kept a very detailed diary himself, a marvelous diary. And the Joseph Smith document may have been with his papers, but all of his material was destroyed in the Chicago fire.
It was never published by Barstow, but it was published in 1842 in the church's newspaper, The Times and Seasons. And it contains not only the account of the first vision and the early history of the church, but it also contains the Articles of Faith.
We should point out that the account was based on the account written by Orson Pratt in Edinburgh, Scotland, in 1840. Instructive for our people, I think, to understand these different accounts and become familiar with them, because each one adds something that the other one leaves out. It was such an experience for Joseph Smith that on different occasions he would bring out certain things in one account that he didn't bring in another. And by bringing these accounts all together and sort of dovetailing them together, it gives you a full, complete understanding of what took place on that occasion of the first vision.
And next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, that is precisely what we will do. We will bring all of these accounts together and reconstruct that morning of a beautiful, clear day early in the spring of 1820. I'm Glenn Rawson. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel, a production of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.